Hello and welcome to the August 2009 edition of Podularity, the online books programme that brings you authors and books in a pod. My name is George Miller, and last month I went down to the Ways with Words Literary Festival at Dartington in Devon to interview Christopher Potter about his recent book, You Are Here, A Portable History of the Universe. As the title and subtitle suggest, Christopher is in pursuit both of the origins and history of the universe and our place in it. I attended Christopher's packed event in Dartington's Great Hall, and afterwards caught up with him for the interview you're about to hear. Christopher, who has spent most of his career as a publisher, writes in the book's first chapter, "Like many who have come to writing late-ish in life, it took a crisis to get me here." So I began by asking him to tell me more about what had led him to tackle such big themes.
I'd really sort of run out of steam, I think, with my work as a publisher. I'd been a publisher for 25 years. But beyond that, there was another sort of crisis. I lived very much in my head. You know, I was a very rational being. And yet I knew there was another sort of part to me that I probably was sort of hidden or private, which is, I suppose, what we might call more spiritual. I actually had a sort of physical and mental breakdown, and it was out of that. Though actually I don't think breakdown is the right term. I like to think of it as a sort of cracking open rather than cracking up, because actually I'm really glad that it happened now. I think it's one of the best things that actually happened in my life. And it's like some sort of deeper part of oneself is telling you that something has to change. And I became very aware that the mind and the body, there's no real distinction to be made between them, particularly in the circumstances I then found myself. You know, I could have a thought that could trigger a panic attack just as much as it might be something that I'd eaten. And there were physical things that had gone unbalanced in my body and in my mind that both triggered this crisis in sort of idea of who I was as a self. And so I suppose that forced me to think, well, what is a material description of the world? And I thought, well, perhaps this is a way of beginning a book that is about my great interest, which is, what is the nature of science? There are a lot of books about what scientists do by scientists or by historians of science, but I didn't feel that there was really a book about the philosophy of science, and that sounds rather high-minded, which I wasn't the kind of book I wanted to write because I'm not a philosopher. But I thought it was a way in for a more general reader who might not otherwise ever read about science, if I could take a more discursive approach to writing about science than actually some sort of catalogue of discoverers and of scientists' biographies, and concentrate more on the ideas and the methodology of science, and which basically can be reduced very simply to the idea that there is some sort of external reality that's made out of things that move. And so scientists go out there with their measuring instruments to determine what it is ultimately that things are made out of and what we mean by motion. And it turns out it's actually very hard to answer those questions, but also the answers that come up are very interesting. And out of that I was able to sort of structure a way of going through the history and philosophy of science as a journey through the universe, through sort of time and different dimensions of space, sizes of space.
You start the book with that experience, which I think most of us have had as children, where you write your address on a book and yes, you gradually expand out until it embraces the whole universe. And you talk about the universe as both attracting and repelling you. And I wanted to ask you to expand a little bit on both the attraction and the repulsion that the universe provokes in you, because that, I suppose, is one of the mainsprings of the book.
Well, I wanted to start with the idea of the address and the thing that we do as children, because I think children instinctively have some sort of understanding that being human is rather an odd and interesting predicament. And children do continually ask why, and they often ask questions that are very hard for adults to answer. And very early on, children are aware or want to know what death is. You know, they are aware that there's something odd about nothingness, or where it is that they've come from so recently, or where it is that dead things go to. as well as this thing that we do as children, where we write out our address and try to place ourselves within the universe as if we need to know what an address means and how we can place this idea of home. So I thought I would start the book, which in some ways was, you know, a ridiculously naive venture to say that I was going to write a book about the universe. I thought, well, I might as well take advantage of that and start from the sort of perspective of a child, with the sort of fears one might have of the immensity of the universe, and try and reassure the reader that I shared some of those fears, and then guide the reader gradually out into the larger universe. And I think some of the fears I have about science are some of the fears I think many people have, and who might, and reasons why they might never read a science book. Science, I think sometimes one can fear that science is going to tell one something that one would rather not know, you know, that we don't have free will or something, or take away the mystery of something, which, you know, Richard Dawkins had his book Unweaving the Rainbow, in which he attempted to show that in fact the mystery increases rather than decreases, which is something I wanted to show too, that actually the more we know about the universe from a material description, in a way the more mysterious and immaterial it begins to appear. And science, I think we, in our age that we live in now, with the great sort of worry about what may actually happen to our planet and what we've done to it, I think perhaps we do need to rethink our relationship to science, that we can't go on just doing science in the old way, where we just think there's an infinite resource of energy and we can just progress in the way that science has progressed. We're having to rethink about the connectedness of everything. And actually, one of the things that I love about science is that it actually reveals the connectedness of things, even though it begins from a premise that things are separate. In a way, the separation is the artificial thing that science does in order to then describe how you can put the pieces back together again. And I find that fascinating. And it's also then an area that begins to relate to other methods of truth seeking, like religion or poetry or music, that also have some instinctive idea that things are actually connected and not separate.
With a lot of cosmology books, I think, well, I'd for one quickly become bamboozled and find that the quantities and the numbers that are being talked about are very difficult to grasp. And I thought you had hit on a very clever and immediate way of making both the very big and the very small graspable. And you use a sort of crescendo and decrescendo in both cases. A little bit about what you were doing there to try and make things more readily seizable.
Well, I thought it was a useful way of actually leading somebody away from their comfort zone quite quickly, and also a way of encompassing initially by going out from things that we're comfortable with and things that we're familiar with, of sizes that are, you know, relate to the size of ourselves as human beings, and then gradually move out from sort of, I don't know, natural objects like trees or rivers and cathedrals, or, I mean, not that they're natural, but I mean man-made objects that are tall, and the Eiffel Tower, and then going out into other powers of size, perhaps out gradually to man-made satellites, and then gradually leaving the Earth altogether and moving to the first natural satellite of the Moon, and on to the nearest, to the planets and the Sun, and then other suns, and structures of galaxies. And it turns out there aren't that many structures. So I could do that quite quickly and show to the reader, well, this is materially what we think's in the universe. But of course, it doesn't answer some of the deeper questions like, what's the universe actually in? So if there are all these structures, why do they end? Why don't they go on endlessly? And so then I was able to come back to other questions about the philosophy of science and what it's actually doing, and a history of motion, that, you know, we don't actually understand the universe by going out into it and exploring it. We've hardly, in fact, travelled very far into the universe at all. The universe comes to us because we see it gravitationally or through light. So in order to understand the universe and know what's in it, we have to interpret that information and ultimately understand what gravity and light are. So in the furthest reaches of science of the book, we actually get to the deepest issues that still face the scientists, which is how to integrate an understanding of gravity and light. Because ultimately, all our descriptions, scientific descriptions, encompass more and more phenomena. So if we ever feel that there is a theory of everything, which many scientists believe that we may one day have, then we have to understand how at the beginning of the universe, how the patch of radiation that expanded, that is the universe that we're in, as we see it 13.7 billion years later, how when it began, the four forces of nature, how they're actually related to each other, how they're integrated as one force. So it's all about unification.
How did you as a writer respond to the challenge of making these cutting-edge theories, which often require advanced science and advanced mathematics that may be mutually incomprehensible to practitioners? How do you begin as a writer to try to convey some of those ideas to the layperson?
Well, initially I wrote a proposal for the book that had no bearing on the finished book at all. I think I was quite fearful of writing a book. I didn't even know whether I could write a sort of joined-up narrative of anything. So I had this sort of idea of timelines and space lines, and I'd have sort of objects hanging from them, and I'd write little notes about them. And then I quickly realized that that wasn't going to work. And I actually spent a couple of years just absorbing myself in the material and doing a lot of reading and thinking about how I might be able to structure the book. And once I actually knew how to tell the story, then oddly enough, it didn't take that long. You know, my fear every day of thinking, well, actually, am I a writer? Do I know how to write? Sort of disappeared once I was doing it each day and I knew where I was going. And once I knew where I was going, then I could find particular texts that were going to help me answer the questions that I knew I needed to answer, or I could allow myself to think about them until I knew that I knew. And it turned out that the internet is a huge resource when you actually know what the question is that you want to answer, and I don't think I could have done it without the internet. I think it would have taken about 10 years longer if I hadn't been able to find these incredible sites like NASA has on particle physics or whatever. You know, there's some incredible stuff out there.
I was particularly taken with your chapter on the origins of life, the conditions in which life on Earth evolved, and the scientists' speculation about the possibility of life on other planets. And I was particularly taken by the contingency, really, it seems, of life. The odds seem to be stacked against life originating on Earth. And I didn't realize that the moon played such a critical part in that. I mean, can you say a little about those sort of particular circumstances which mean that we are here?
Well, in a way, the story of the universe is very simple. It's about evolution. It's about a patch of radiation that evolves and then becomes things with mass that come together under gravity and create stars that burn and form heavy metals and blow up, and there are simple compounds. And then, but I suppose the big question is, well, how much life is there in the universe? How special do the conditions need to be in order for life to appear? Well, already you can begin to see that, well, you need several life cycles of stars, for example, so because if you're going to have life based on heavy metals, then that's where they come from. So that immediately tells you need a certain number of billion years. But then as the story progresses and we look at the conditions, because in order to work out whether there is life anywhere else, we have to have some deep understanding of what life is here and what it looks like and what's special about it in order then to go and look for it elsewhere. Which is why only recently have we been able to find other systems that have planets as large as Jupiter in it, because we haven't been able to see planets that small before. And now, a few years even beyond that, we're able to almost beginning to be able to find planets the size of Earth out there. And once we begin to see those, then we can look for other things that might turn out that there are comparable places like Earth. But there are an immense number of things that make life seem improbable. I mean, Jupiter's one of them, but then we're finding, because the size of Jupiter actually prevents massive objects from bumping into Earth and actually destroying our atmosphere and sort of effectively making life have to start again the whole time. Well, we know there are lots of other solar systems with Jupiter's in, so that solves that issue slightly. Except you're always then reducing the number of possibilities where life can be. But then the moon, we're very lucky that we only have one moon, and it has to, in that it's of this particular size, because if we had several moons, there'd be these incredible gravitational tides that would cause all sorts of havoc with the stability of the Earth. But the moon is just at the right sort of size and distance that it can stabilize our orbit and stop the Earth from flipping around on its axis, which would be very disturbing to life. Then the presence of water, which is one of the things I suppose we all know of, that we're always looking for water in other parts of the universe, because the Earth is the only place we know of so far in the universe where water exists in its all three of its possible states: ice, liquid water, and steam, water vapor. And water is absolutely crucial to life, because water, not only is it, we're made mostly of water, but actually in an inorganic way, water is the sort of oil of the tectonic plates, and the tectonic plates wouldn't move if there wasn't water. And if the tectonic plates didn't create volcanoes and ridges and spew out gases into the Earth, there wouldn't be an atmosphere. And if there wasn't an atmosphere, life wouldn't be possible. And if there wasn't an atmosphere with the amounts of carbon dioxide in it that require the Earth to be warm enough, then life wouldn't have been possible either. And though, of course, now we're worried that we're going to make it too warm through our own interference in these incredibly intimate cycles of connectivity between the organic and inorganic landscapes, that we now begin to think, well, perhaps there isn't really a distinction between the organic and the inorganic in quite the way we had thought before, which I suppose we owe to Lovelock and this idea of sort of Gaia.
You mentioned at the beginning that spiritual questions were on your mind, and that much is clear from reading the book. And I wondered what place you felt there was for God in at least asking these questions, even if not answering them.
Well, I think there's plenty of room for God. You know, I feel like I'm skeptical in the broadest sense possible, because I also feel I'm skeptical of materialism, because I'm not one of those people that think that if we just wait long enough we'll get a material answer to everything. I think materialism is a sort of methodology that we apply to the outside world, and what we get back is what we call the material world. But to say that the material world will ultimately be everything is quite a leap of faith, and not one I'm really prepared to make. And in any case, the material world may look very peculiar and very different from what it is now, and may encompass other thoughts of other methods of truth seeking. So why not acknowledge those now? You know, they may absolutely aid us in how we move forward as scientists. So I would say there was plenty of room for God, and not just in the starting conditions.
You mentioned towards the end of the book the sort of possibility of the sort of convergence of different sort of truths, the scientific truth and the truth of the theologians and the truth of the artists, that there may in some future moment be some kind of convergence between them.
We probably think traditionally of science as though you go out there and you make a measurement of something that seems to be happening out there, and then you have a theory about it which is underpinned by mathematics, and out of that comes technology, and you make finer measuring instruments, and you're in this sort of loop. But actually a lot of science progresses by insight, and also the mathematics that underpins science, which is one of the greatest mysteries of all, why actually mathematics is something that underpins our description of reality, why it works, is deeply connected to poetry. I mean, all the words that we use to apply to poetry, you could just as well apply to mathematics: elegance, beauty. And pattern seeking is as true in aesthetics as it is in science. That's what science does. It looks for connections and patterns. And it's hard to know where insight comes from, because if you're having an insight before you've actually got your theory to describe it, well, where does the insight come from? There must be some other way that is almost like where poetry comes from, that is also true of science. Science is different because it has its own definition of what progress is, and it's so successful in what it does that we often don't think we need to ask, well, what actually is it doing? And so I think sometimes there's a confusion between its methodology and what it actually finds out about the world. We tend not to make the separation.
I was talking to Christopher Potter about You Are Here, a portable history of the universe, which is out now in hardback. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe free to further editions simply by typing Podularity in the search box on iTunes. Until next time, thank you for listening, and goodbye.